Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to a special post-season bonus episode of Still Watching The White Lotus, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Richard Lawson. We're here to share our conversation with The White Lotus's creator, director, writer, all-around mastermind, Mike White, which is a real thrill. He is such a sharp, funny guy and has made such a sharp, funny, sad, spooky, whatever show.
Sexy, carnal, fantastic, and hit a lot of insights to share, and he's a big fan of one of my co-hosts.
Well, we don't have to get into that. But anyway, so we're going to hear that first, and then afterward, Chris and I will kind of reconvene, have some final thoughts, and then that'll be it for this season. So let's go to Mike now. Well, we have the distinct pleasure now. We've been waiting all season. We are on the line with the mastermind behind The White Lotus, Mike White. Mike, hello.
Hey.
So there's so much to talk about, but I think we have to address the big matter up front. It's our question is, when did you know what Tanya's fate would be? Is that how this season started in your mind, or did you arrive there later on?
Well, I guess I was thinking it would be fun to bring her back, and I may have mentioned this in the little wrap up that they did after the show. But her last line in the first season was, you know, I've had all these treatments. I've tried every treatment in the world. And like, death is the last immersive experience I haven't tried. And it started from there. It was just like, well, maybe it'd be funny if we brought her back that she would die. Not funny, but whatever. Yeah, funny. But that, and then and then I got to Italy and it was like, you know, Sicily and like kind of like the mythology and the opera and like, you know, the idea of like the kind of tragic heroine, and Tanya seems to fit the mold of that. So it just felt like it just, yeah. So I started building the whole season kind of around that idea that maybe she would die.
The way that Tanya goes is so devastating. She almost gets out. She gets a big Godfather-esque, you know, set piece where she murders all these gays. And then she sort of, as you said, on the wrap-up on HBO, she sort of derps into the water. It's a derpy death. Can you talk to us about why you decided to have her go in that specific way?
Well, I was just like, I don't want her to actually be murdered. It just felt too grim. Although I think we could have gone that direction too, but I just was like, it should be kind of like larger than life, like just like her, you know, like shooting her way through that boat. And But then it felt like that was so on brand for her. I hate that phrase, but yeah, it was on brand for her, like where she's like, yeah, just the derpiest way to go. Like she's actually makes it past the peril and she just takes herself out.
After some sort of failed little pep talk, like I can do this.
Yeah, you've got,
like,
this.
Oh,
got
this. Poor Tanya. How did that conversation go with Jennifer Coolidge? I mean, did she kind of see the vision of why that was where Tanya was headed?
Well, I had pitched the whole idea of like that she kind of like you do this kind of like fake out of like a Stella gets her groove back with like her meeting up with a bunch of gay guys. And I don't know, like that. And then it turns out they're like it's a cabal of like evil gays who are trying to kill her. HBO loved the pitch. And so I was like, oh, yeah, I thought it was funny and I was so excited. So like when I told Jennifer, I thought she was going to find it really, but she was, you know, like, understandably, she was like, you're going to kill me? Like, and even like last night, I wanted to watch it with her. So I just went over to her house and the two of us watched it together. And I was like, you know, I was excited about the finale because I worked really hard on it, and like, was like happy with how it came out. And like, and then I'm watching it with her and I'm like, and I realized like, it's like she liked the show, but there is something sad about killing Tanya. And also like, it is the end of like, you know, obviously it's not gonna be the end of me working with Jennifer. I want to work with her again, but it is kind of maybe the end of the road for Tanya on White Lotus and Jennifer on White Lotus, which is sad, but it is sad for me too. So.
I was watching with my boyfriend and he was like, well, goodbye, Tanya. And I said, no, she could still be alive. Her eyes could open. You know, I was clearly wrong.
She was pitching stuff like that. Even like when we got her in the tank, in the water tank, she's like, maybe we should just do one where she like wakes up and she like, you know, pulls herself out of. We didn't shoot that.
Is there any commentary in the sort of, you know, she's having her Stella moment with these cool rich gay guys. They don't turn out to be bad. Like, to me, it read a bit almost like a commentary on that sort of symbiotic relationship between a certain kind of woman and a certain kind of gay guy. Was that in your mind at all when you were doing the writing?
Well, there's definitely, you know, we were, you know, it's throughout the season there, there's a lot of sense of like male, the potential for like male violence against women and like and this idea of like that you know heterosexual men and women are kind of in, you know, in a kind of like perpetual state of friction, and that there's like this, you know, like, you know, this eternal power struggle, like and the idea that gay guys are potentially like a solace or like refuge from that drama, and that like and so I just thought, especially in Sicily where it's, you know, such a machismo culture, and you know, like this idea of like, you know, men and like, you know, like the Godfather, and so I just was like, it'd be kind of a fresh thing that if like the actual villains are like kind of the, you know, the flamboyant gay guys who are like trying to decorate their houses, and it's like not coming from any of those like more kind of classic, you know, cliched, like, you know, sources of violence against women.
The gays, I mean, the gays are trying to murder me is a phrase I've said a million times as a gay, as a gay person. Did you know when you conceptualize this with Jennifer, and knowing that gay people just love Jennifer Coolidge and she sort of became sort of like a gay icon because of the first season of The White Lotus, did that play into that as well in terms of your, you know, turning that on its head?
Yeah, I just thought, I mean, there was some movie that had come out when right before I started writing that Jennifer was in. I forget the name of it. I'm embarrassed to say, but it was like a Netflix movie, and it was like there was something in the trailer where she's like saying like, oh, all the gays are obsessed with me. And like, it was like, and I was like, oh God, like, I was like, like if we're going to go into this, like I don't know, like this kind of like a little bit of a cliche dynamic or something, or just a dynamic that you would expect with her that it would have to have a different, ultimate reveal, I guess.
We have a theory that Daphne would be the character on The White Lotus that would do the best on Survivor. Is this
oh,
true?
For sure. Definitely. 100%. I mean, Daphne is like a classic. I mean, she kind of reminds me of Parvati a little bit.
Mm.
Where yeah. she's just like, yeah, you know, easy breezy, like, you know, man killer, just nothing gets, you know, she's just perpetually not bothered.
Can turn on the sweetness when she wants, makes a good final tribal speech, you know. Yeah. So obviously Tanya was brought in from the first season, but you had to fill out everything around her with all of these new characters. How did you start building that? I mean, there seems to be some stuff here and there that is, you know, reacting to online discourse or just sort of cultural conversation over the last few years, and some that just feel totally their own entire unique creation. So how did you go about building the world of this hotel, I guess?
Well, I was just trying to, I wanted, yeah, I realized it was going to be, you know, it kind of, the first season wasn't this, but I feel like, you know, you do a hotel show, it's like, there's a, you just kind of imagine, you know, like a Neil Simon, whatever, like that it's basically like, the bedroom farce yeah. aspect of
noise
it.
Is off.
And so So I was just feeling like, you know, I should really embrace that and do that in a way that maybe feels a little bit more dangerous, or, you know, that it's, you know, not just a light, you know, wrong. Farce. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I love stuff that's about comparative anxiety. So like having two couples felt like a fun one, you know, like that kind of just... was, you know, it's like, I guess as I was thinking about it, I was like, what are different kinds of, you know, classic, you know, people on vacations, you know, like, and so the two couples felt that, like, that made sense. And then I had recently gone on a trip with my dad to Sweden to find his our heritage, because we have family from, like, the hinterlands of Sweden. And so the idea of, like, you know, like, and I know a lot of Italian Americans who are very proud of, you know, especially Sicilians, like. And so I was just like, and having three generations of men dealing with their, you know, whatever masculine crises, just kind of, yeah, felt like a good sort of counterbalance to Tanya and her female assistant, who are like, you know, struggling with love and looking for love or whatever. And so, you know, it's like, and then, you know, the Italian characters kind of like, I wanted it to feel like it was like, you know, kind of a slow build, but that like by the end it's like a very horny, like Bosch, like it's like by the end, like there's just like the desire is coming in every direction, and the you know, the sexual jealousy, and like, you know, just building to like a kind of operatic crescendo was my hope. So,
and Sicily fits so well into that. I mean, I was there with my family earlier this year. We also went to the town where my mom's family's from and were disappointed. We were not chased by an artichoke wielding older woman, but we came close. And like the stuff with the head, you know, this lore about the woman who was scorned. I mean, it really all fits so well together. And I know that you said in that the little kind of post show after the episode for HBO that like this season was about sex. The first season was more about money. Obviously those things are intertwined in both seasons, but like, why did sex kind of fall to you as like that? This is the bigger theme of season two. Did it feel like the kind of natural evolution or how did that go?
Well, that wasn't the plan originally. I had this idea for like, you know, I don't know, like some, I had a, like a totally different concept for the second season, but then we started scouting properties, and we found, you know, the one in Taormina that we ended up using, and it was just like, this is originally the idea was like a business, like a Bilderberg, like, you know, all the, like, you know what, I don't know, like more of like not a business conference, but like where all the big muckety mucks come together to like destroy the world. And so I was like, but then we got to Taormina, I was like, you don't come here for that. So right. It just felt like it had so much more. And the Test of Demoras really are everywhere. And like hearing the story about the Test of Demoras, I was like, well, this is, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's such a rich and classic kind of, it's so fertile for storyline, obviously. Sexual jealousy and people's obsessions with fidelity and cheating and It was inspired by being in the place and feeling like that kind of, it just called out for that, I guess.
A big spewing volcano and
erupting,
visible everywhere. That certainly worked. I think, speaking of the sex, I had read that filming sex scenes was not something you were particularly eager to do, and yet it was sort of built inherently into this season. Did your feelings about how to stage those things evolve over the course of shooting?
This isn't necessarily my normal, this isn't my wheelhouse as a director, and I get very awkward about asking people to, I don't know, I thought I got better. I got better after a while. It's it's like Survivor, where the first time you vote somebody off, you cry and you feel bad, and you're like, was that, and then after a while you're just vote them off. Let's put all these people off. So it was So over time it just was there was somebody sent me a Twitter where it was a scene from some movie where it was a little meme where this woman was telling these kids strip. It's this Mike White on the White Lotus. I was take your clothes off. Let's do this. But it was the cast was cool. It wasn't that gnarly, but it is always awkward. And you have these, intimacy coordinators, which are actually I find really helpful, because then I can just, it's easier to use them as a buffer to, and for the actors, sometimes actors don't want to tell the director, they don't want to do something, they want to be, team players and, whatever. And so it allows them to have somebody that they, can give the reel to.
Yeah. We actually just interviewed Megan Fahey, and she was talking about your directing style, and she was like, you give great notes, but you also give the actors a lot of space to sort of make choices and do what they want to do. You're not super prescriptive, and also there's a lot of ambiguity in terms of what actually happened on the show, and you don't necessarily fill in all the backstory for the actors. Can you talk about your sort of directing approach and how you work with actors and why you sort of aren't so concerned with this is what you were doing 10 years ago or 20 years ago in terms of a backstory for these characters?
I hate talking about, I hate talking in abstractions really about, characters and stuff like that. I also just basically try to hide from the actor. Really? I'm always hiding, but I after a while, you've been doing it for a while. I kind of have a sense of what I know I need from a scene. And so then as long as I get that, then I feel like I want the actors to feel like they can, try stuff and do things. And so, because if it doesn't work, I won't use it. But then often it really does work, and it allows them to really, have more ownership. When I was younger, because I come as a writer to it, and I never really even wanted to direct. I really was just liked writing, but I was more particular about hearing the line in my head and wanting the line to sound like that. And, having more, being more prescriptive. And I don't know, I started annoying myself. So I was just and also you realize it's having a more open approach creates a funner set. You get better work out of people. I enjoy myself more. So I try not to be too niggly.
in the writing, obviously this is a second season, and you want to have it be still a familiar show to people who were big fans of the first season. There is a death at the beginning, etc. But you also obviously had to make it different. I think one of the big differences that we really loved at the end of this season is that, in the first season, Armand, the poor, put upon, working class guy, dies and the rich guy gets away with it. And in this, Mia and Lucia, who could, and Valentina too, are sort of, you know, they're Armin's equivalent, and yet
they win.
Sort they're of end on a happy note.
Walk into the sunset.
I assume you see that as a happy note. And was that a conscious thing to differentiate it from the first season?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like in a way it's more, I would put it into, since it's not really as much about class and it's more mm-hmm. about like women and men or whatever. I do think, you know, it was fun to have a different kind of ending. And I certainly, you know, a lot of people were bummed by some of the people, staff's fates in the first season. But I also was like, you know, like my take was a little bit more like Tanya's a tragic character because she really doesn't know what she wants. She's lost. She's, you know, like she's just searching and she never can land. And she thinks love is going to save her, or a guy's going to save her. And like in a little bit like Portia's has this issue. And like what I felt about Mia and Lucia is like they're women who know what they want. They know what they want. This is they state what they want. They go out to get what they want, and they get what they want. And they're like, yeah. And they also are. And they have this like, you know, their friendship is I don't know, like that they're real helpmates to each other to achieve their goals. You know, you can compare it to like Tanya and Portia, who are like, it's all so fraught. And they're all, you know, they blamey and like frustrated. And so, yeah. So, I definitely, it is different than the first season as far as like, the poor characters aren't crushed, but it was a little bit more designed around the ideas of women and I don't know, like, and some of that as opposed to trying to do something different than the first season as far as class.
Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment.
I'm Nomi Fry, and this week on Critics at Large, we're talking about the delights and shortcomings of the new movie Challengers. It starred Zendaya at the center of a tennis triangle and a very steamy love triangle.
Who are her loyalties to? Will she be tempted by the other one? How do these guys reckon their professional playing ambition with their romantic and sexual feelings about this mysterious woman? And such we have it. We have a conflict between three people in a game meant for two.
Is it a sports movie or a sex movie? Find out on Critics at Large from The New Yorker. New episodes drop every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I have to ask, because this really did crack me up. The biggest reveal of potentially the series happened in the final episode when Cameron casually mentions, yeah, we were roommates at Yale. And that got a lot of play, you know, online, and people really sort of...
Yale Twitter was a buzz.
Yale Twitter was blowing up.
Oh, no.
Was there a specific reason why you saved that for then and you chose that specific college? Because it does really make a lot of sense, honestly.
It's funny because actually there wasn't even scripted, I don't think. Theo wanted to add something about that, about like being put in, like the line itself. But then he was like, well, where did they go to school? And I was like, I don't know. And I was just looking, and I was like, probably Yale, right? And I'm not trying to say anything about Yale. I love Yale. Oh my God.
Yeah, you can. It's a safe space if you wanted to say anything.
I think they'll be okay.
Well, I went to Wesleyan, you know, so we were like the like redheaded stepchild to Yale, you know. We were the, you know, it was the school where all the kids who didn't get into Yale went to try to go to Wesleyan,
well,
I guess.
You're doing great now. Also, another recurring theme too, is which we have to mention because we work there. A couple of Vanity Fair mentions throughout the show too.
Oh yeah, we did. We give Vanity Fair a shout out.
Should we? Is that like a good thing or a bad? Should we be offended or is that like a good?
I mean, that's just such a go-to magazine for like people on vacation who are this kind of people. I don't know if that's an insult, but no, I mean, no, you know, no, there's there's great writing and, you know,
I think
beautiful long form stuff. But it's, I mean, you know, White Lotus is kind of, I mean, I hate to say it, but I mean, now I'm insulting both of us. But like, I feel like White Lotus is, you know, it is basically the kind of thing. I don't know. There's a crossover for White Lotus and Vanity Fair readers.
Oh,
do you
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, like people who like to, you know, I don't know. Like you want the juice on rich people, but like in a kind of high-minded, gussied up as high-minded, you know, long form.
I mean, we're literally profiting off of it by having this podcast, so we do see the overlap.
And the listener responses, I think, confirm that overlap, certainly. So we appreciate it.
We really do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, I'm here to help you with your content.
So obviously the audience was surprised by a lot of things that happened in this final episode. It's maybe a corny writer question, but like, was there anything that surprised you as you were writing? You were like, oh, I kind of didn't see this plot line going this way until I got there, you know, literally in the final draft document.
Well, the one that was the most tricky to write was these couples storyline, and I wanted to, it wasn't clear that I was going to shift focus, you know, I wanted to do something about how like men cheating is kind of how that is processed, and then how the idea of women cheating and how that is processed and that like the stakes get like more tweaked or crazier because of and so like trying to like figure out exactly how to pass the baton between Harper's point of view and then ending up being Ethan's point of view and how to like actually the logistics of that was the one where I was just like, I hope this lands. And even like when we cut the final, you know, it was like, you know, sometimes it's not until you actually cut the last episode where you're like, oh, this kind of, I don't know, like where the full, you know, the just, you know, it's like, do we need to reshoot this? I was happy with how it landed, but yeah, it was, that one was like the one where I'm just like, cause I wanted, just trying to keep everybody's perspective and keep it clear, you know, like not getting it too messy.
It's obviously intentionally ambiguous to the audience in terms of what did or didn't happen with Harper and Cameron and Daphne and Ethan and whatnot. Do you know what happened or what didn't happen, or are you not really concerned with, you know, what's not shown to the audience?
Well, my philosophy was like, you know, Daphne says at the end of the season where it's in the scene with Ethan, she's like, you know, a little mystery is kind of, you know, like it's okay to not, you know, it's like you can survive not knowing everything about, you know, your partner's fidelity, or you know, like that there it's okay to have it be, you know, you can live with the mystery, I guess. And so I felt like that was kind of the approach to what happens with Harper and Cameron in the room, and also what happens with Ethan and Daphne on the island. And like, you know, you kind of have a sense of it, but like, you know, like that, like we as the audience are also in that state of not fully knowing. And I think it makes it more, in a way, more sexy, you know, because it's like you can kind of fill it in, and also more, ambiguous in a way that's, you know, it gets to the, like, you know, the anxiety that the characters are also experiencing in that state of not knowing.
Because there are always going to be things they don't know, you know, and maybe they've entered into a more sort of, I don't know, egalitarian open relationship. I mean, I don't know. But
upper crust society. Yeah.
I'm also curious about your decision to, right before we see Mia and Lucia skipping off into their happy futures, we hope. The show then, right before that, ends with Albi and Portia having this kind of reset moment of like, let's kind of almost reintroduce ourselves to each other. We'll exchange phone numbers. How did you view their sort of arc back toward one another? Was it that they just went on these adventures and then decided, oh, actually, I kind of want to be a little more boring than that? Or
is it sad?
Yeah. Is it sad? Is it happy?
No, I don't. I mean, with the Portia storyline, she wants this, adventure and mystery, and like she wants to get lost. And then like she, clearly has that moment where she actually has having an adventure and realizes it's not what she wants. She wants to, she's like, get the fuck out of here. Yeah. So like, to me, it was just like, it's a very cynical show. There's a lot of cynical like moves here. And so I just kind of, to me, wasn't supposed to be read as sad. It was more like, the having a little bit of hope for a kind of, whether they're conventional characters in the conventional kind of romance, but that it was cute. You know what I mean? That there's some kind of, they are the kind of young lovers and originally, the setting this up is like, oh, it's a, it's a summer romance, this storyline, and then like undermining that, but then maybe kind of healing it a little bit at the end.
And they are in some ways like Albie is maybe breaking his father's cycle and Portia is like, I'm not going to become Tanya.
Yeah.
So there is, I think, a finality to that. But this is not the end of The White Lotus. I mean, you said in the post thing on HBO that like there are some thoughts already in place about what season 3 could be. We hear Daphne say next year in the Maldives. I don't know if that's supposed to be a clue to anything. But is there anything you can share with us about the, even if it's very in its nascent stages, development of another idea?
What I realized last time was like, I didn't want to get too ahead of it because you go to a place and you realize, there's a whole, that I kind of really need to go. I don't know what country we're shooting in. I don't know anything. So it's like, I do feel like it needs a strong theme because I feel like that gives it more of a reason, than just being like a situational. And I have a lot to say. Lots of things. Obviously we are going to scout. I don't know why I say it. Obviously, we are going to scout in Asia. Looking at countries there. And so my instinct is that maybe it has something to do with, spirituality, Eastern versus Western religion, or Western people in an Eastern, culture with like, that maybe after sex, it would be nice to have something that's a little more celestial or something that's a little more out of the carnal, I guess. But I don't know. I have to beg off, to be honest, because I don't really know.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. It goes back to Enlightenment. I mean, there's a through line there in terms of your previous work in Enlightenment. So.
Yeah. It turns out people show up a lot more for sex than they do for spiritual.
Sex in a dead body. Is that? That's crazy.
Turns out the hooks do really bring out the people.
Is the idea to shoot in Asia at all? I've been binging so much Survivor the past month and a half, so it's on my mind. Is that based at all in your experience in Fiji, or is the connection not there?
Is Fiji Asia?
I guess it's Oceania. It's, I guess yeah, Pacific. Yeah.
Pacific.
Yeah. But I maybe there is a Survivor connection in the the early Survivors. It was like, so much of it was like, Survivors in Africa, the Australian outback, like the location was such a big part of the vibe of the show and the concepts around the show. And I I love traveling, so that's selfishly, but I also felt like, Sicily being there, it just inspired me to come up with something, that maybe I wouldn't have come up with if we were staying in, America or keeping it close to home. So like, I just like the idea of that maybe, going somewhere really different, will come up with, something that feels fresh and also show, I like, showing off another part of the world. And it's like, if we kept doing that, you know, so I don't know. There's something very, I feel like there's a positive aspect to cultures, you know, like us as a crew going to a place that's different. I don't know. That part of it excites me. So
now that Tanya is sadly no longer with us, do you think you'll have another, you know, one character from either one of the seasons travel, you know, as a through line, or are you, there's that?
Yeah. I was definitely, I mean, I like that idea. I don't know exactly who I've had some conversations about that, but yeah, it would be fun to have some through line to maybe one of the other guests, maybe from the first season. But you know, you have to figure out who's available and what, like, when, you know, so there's stuff I don't really know, but like, yeah, it would be fun also, like, I mean, I don't know how long I can keep doing this show, but like, you know, I do think, like, again, to speak to Survivor, it'd be fun to have an All-Stars season
I just fainted.
That,
yeah,
literally, yeah. I just jumped out of my seat. That would be that would be unreal.
Yeah. Yeah.
It could be funny to have different worlds collide.
As long as Jack's somewhere in the background swimming in the pool, I'm happy.
Oh, really? Okay. I'll keep that in mind.
I'll get my Love Island hunk in there, yeah.
Well, in the meantime, we can savor this excellent season that we just watched.
It was so amazing. And thanks for stopping by. This is amazing.
And go bask in the success, and then, we'll see you in a couple years for season three.
See you in Fiji.
Okay. Bye, guys.
Take care. All right, Chris, before we go, we should do it just a kind of final summative, like, what do we think? For me, this season was always entertaining, always engaging, but I worried at times, I was like, you know, it feels a little thinner. Maybe it was just because, like, sex and romance and all that felt a little bit more
played out, you know, or it's been done before.
Yeah, it's been done before with the class stuff in the first season. But, you know, by the end, and actually even just talking to Mike now, like, I see the sort of depth that was really operating on. And I think sometimes you just have to wait till the end. Do you agree?
I totally agree. I think at the beginning, I remember we talked about, okay, Tanya, like, what is she really doing here again? It felt a little slow, a little thin, but as we just talked to Mike White, that was sort of all by design. He knew Tanya was going, kaput by the end of the season. And so he said even, you know, building up to the eruption, the explosion of the final episode, tracing it back, it's one of those shows that, like, rewatching it was even better than watching it the first time, going back each episode, knowing what was coming next, because it is a grand sort of arc. It's sort of like a 7-hour movie.
Yeah,
if you will.
Or a big mural that you would find in Italy.
Yes,
you know,
or a fresco.
A fresco. That's what I mean. Not a mural. I agree, and I think that, you know, in the sort of business-minded, cynical way, if you want to put it that way, I'm now really ready for season three. I didn't really think there should be a season two.
I remember
that. Like, but he has sold me on the idea that this could be a sort of iterative show that each season will tackle with some, you know, familiar stuff intact, but will tackle a different theme. Mike White has maybe said death, at least in the post-show interview.
Spirituality.
Yeah, like something like that. So that's intriguing. And, you know, he expressed some worry that, like, oh, maybe the sex was the most, like, grabby thing, and I don't know if they're going to be as interested. But I disagree. I think I'm more interested even than I was before.
Yeah. I mean, as we said, even though the second season was about sex and the first season was about money, there's so much connection between all of these themes. Everything is connected. So if he's, you know, if he does go to East Asia and does a season on spirituality or religion, I think there'll still be some sex. I think there'll still be some money. I think there'll still be some class. That's inescapable when you're dealing with sort of this enclave of the 1% and these uber rich people that other things don't, explode, you will. So I'm not that I was ever worried about Mike White, but even the few reservations that I did have going into season two, he completely exceeded my expectations.
Yeah. And you know what else exceeded our expectations is we have really appreciated getting so much feedback from the listeners who've been emailing us. That's been such a help in terms of how we guide conversations And
also the theories were so smart. There's a lot of stuff that we didn't know or notice.
Much better theorizers than us.
Much
out
there. Better. Much yeah. smarter. All the emails were so fantastic. Yeah. I do love hearing that people love the pod. That's something I never get sick of.
Yeah. And thank you for that. And, you know, you can always email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com if you have, you know, maybe there's a show that we should cover that we haven't thought to cover for a season next year. We are going to take a bit of a break for the holiday, but we will be back next year. We're not sure what we're doing yet, but we're going to figure that out in the coming weeks. So if you have any suggestions, please do email us. In the meantime, you can also find me at Twitter. I'm at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S. Chris?
And I am at Christress, C-H-R-I-S-T-R-E-S-S.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our editor and producer is Dave Gonzalez, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes and Katie Rich. Our engineer is Jake Loomis. Steven Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. So we'll be back next year. Until then, thanks again for listening. Chris, thanks for taking the trip to Sicily with me. Now let's actually go to Sicily.
No, we really have to. We'll get an Aperol Spritz there. I'll buy you an Aperol Spritz in Sicily.
Okay, because Chris is drunk off the case that we gave him yesterday. So. All right, well, until then, we'll see you soon.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.